Welcome to the Plant Grow Reap podcast.
Welcome back to Plant Grow Reap. Today we are joined by Craig Ford from Cyber Unicorns, which is a mobile education platform designed to help build strong cybersecurity habits. Welcome, Craig. Was that an accurate summary of a small part of what you do? Do you want to tell us a little bit more about what you do more broadly? We've already been talking about it a little bit.
Yep, no problem. So yes, that is certainly part of what we do. Cyber Unicorns is a company I founded a little over 2 years ago now. So essentially it's a cybersecurity consultancy company like most other cybersecurity companies, but with that difference that you said, we kind of created it and sort of really drove that from a passion I have around cyber education, particularly around the general public kind of space, so your mums and dads, your seniors, you know, kids and that whole general public. And it started with my books, which we can get to in a bit of a conversation, but essentially it's sort of that's the passion I go for, and I'm really trying to make a bit of a difference in that education space, which was the reason the mobile education app and the cyber app sort of came out, and really trying to thrive and push as much education out there in that general public space.
Yeah. And I have to ask, where did the name Cyber Unicorns come from?
It's twofold kind of answer here, and I'll go through a bit of both, but essentially it's a bit of an inside joke between my wife and I, but I'll tell you why.
That's the perfect origin for a business name.
It is. So essentially a cyber unicorn, or a unicorn in the cyberspace, is what we would call in the industry someone that is very, very technical, but really good at communicating and breaking down that high technical jargon into something easy to understand. So essentially that's me in a nutshell,
yep.
The way I sort of act and the way I sort of go with my writing and the education and everything I do. So I would be classed as what you would say a unicorn in cyberspace.
But I imagine because it's a rare thing to be able to do both.
It is very much. Usually you either are very, very good at communicating or you're very, very technical. They don't normally go both. There is a few of us around, but yes, usually not both. But the specific reason for our company being named Cyber Unicorns, obviously there's a bit of a twofold around the education and communicating, but it was a random conversation in a shopping centre between my wife and I when we were first talking around doing the education and doing the business. And I was sitting and I randomly said, for the same reason that I'm highly technical and I'm really good at communicating, and I was a unicorn, and the poor lady behind me spat her drink, whatever she was drinking, all over the floor, cracking up laughing. She goes, "You probably shouldn't say that too loud." And it kind of just stuck as a bit of a personal joke between my wife and I. So as soon as we said, you know, we're going to do it, it's time to make the business, my wife, Melissa, said, 100% it has to be Cyber Unicorns. And I'm like, it does.
And it stands out, like, against the plethora of cyber-related businesses out there, the unicorn does stand out as a unique selling point.
It does. And I think particularly around the kids' cyber education, trying to reach the community side, the bright colours, the really trying to encourage that diverse kind of thinking and that little bit different.
Yeah.
Yeah, it worked perfect.
It does help. It does help. And you said that, so it's been about 2 years that you've been working this. What was the lead up to that? Like, I imagine there was a lot of, oh, should we, or it should look like this. What was the development journey?
There's a little bit of a, particularly the education side, the reason to make the jump out and to do the education itself is I must have talked on probably 100 of podcasts and conversations like this before and interviews, and I kept finding myself saying that somebody should go out and create cyber education for that general public kind of space and really try and make a difference and do that, what you would call like the sunscreen slip, slop, slap kind of campaign.
Like a really snappy campaign. Yes, that
something that everyone will kind of listen to and sort of understand and actually sink in a little bit. And I'm like going, someone should do it, someone should do it, someone should do it. And I'm like, I should just do it. I should stop talking about it and stop talking about it. So it was literally that was the spark of I should actually just do something.
Yeah.
Obviously, I was in a nice, cushy CTO role.
So yeah.
It was, you know, a bit of a scary jump out of, you know, a pretty comfortable CTO role and in that sort of, you know, managed service security space to out jumping out on our own. But yeah, I haven't looked back since, so it's pretty good.
Well, that's very positive, especially for the first sort of 2 years in business. It can be a bit of a chaotic time and a very steep learning curve. So is it your first foray into
doing my own?
Yeah?
Yes, 100% first foray. And I've heard it a few times that if you can survive the first 12 months, you're going pretty good.
I have also heard that. Yeah. What has surprised you the most about being a business owner?
I kind of thought it would be harder than it is. Like, yeah. I think I'm juggling it better than I expected. I thought I'd really sort of struggle with the accounting side of things and doing more the mundane kind of stuff, but it seems to go reasonably well. I think it's probably the best decision I ever made, to be honest, to jump out and create the unicorns. So I think, definitely love it. Definitely want to keep doing more of that.
I think that is always the best recipe for a successful business, is when there's already that passion there. You'd already identified that there was a gap in the market, and just having the interest in the area and the passion for the area, it just keeps, it'll drive you through all the mundane stuff, as he says.
It definitely does. And I think probably for Cyber Unicorn's sake, I think it's a bit of a bonus, because I'm a, what you would call a fractional CISO, so a fractional Chief Information Security Officer, which I do as part of Cyber Unicorns for Wesley Mission, Police Citizens Youth Club and RespectX. So I have a few clients that help keep putting the lights on while I do all my passion projects and keep pushing the education side, so it works quite well together.
Yeah. Speaking of passion projects, you indicated to the book. Do you want to talk a little bit about the book, which I presume is a passion project?
It definitely was. And sort of, so this one in particular, so Foresight, I have 6 books now, writing number 7. This is my first in my hacker fantasy cyberpunk novel series.
Oh, nice.
This one particularly, I'm actually pretty stoked about. I've actually won 3 international book awards for.
Congratulations.
Won another one for the kids' book I co-authored with Katie Randall, The Shadow World, as well. So yeah, it's pretty excited as an Australian author to win 3 international awards.
Yeah, that's huge.
In New York, because New York as an author or a writer is basically that's the home of books. So if you get something there or win any awards there, that's basically kind of the pinnacle
of course.
Any author, which is pretty exciting. But yeah, to win 2 in 2 different awards is pretty cool. But
yeah, I'm glad you brought it up, because it absolutely is something to be incredibly proud of, because it's significant. And I imagine as well, sort of marrying what you're doing in your technical cyber expertise and the education part, and then bringing that together and putting it into a creative outlet like a fiction book, that's fantastic.
It's very different too, and particularly like if you got the 3 different series I have. So the kids book one I mentioned I did with Katie Randall, so The Shadow World. So it's for cyber education for around 6 to about 14-year-olds, 12-year-olds. So it's sort of helping them along the journey, tells stories and kind of educates them in that online safety, cyberbullying, even sextortion, which is a really hard topic for parents and stuff to have conversations about. So it's kind of that education. And then my first 2 books, which is my Hacker AM series, essentially is an adult kind of cyber education, which I wrote because literally when I did my first master's degree, I have 2, but we won't get into that conversation.
Okay.
But when I was doing my first master's, I hated cybersecurity textbooks and thought they were the most boring, horriblest thing to read. So I decided I'd write my own, which I thought would be a little bit better, a bit more entertaining, a bit more educational. And they're still probably my most popular book, which is pretty exciting. But and then Foresight was kind of born the hacker fantasy, because I do a regular column for the Women in Security magazine, which essentially I kind of wanted to do something as a man in the industry. What could I do to encourage more teenage girls, more young girls, a bit of an interest in cyber? So I created Sam, the lead female character, trying to encourage that more of a spark, a bit of an interest, which has been hugely popular, which is awesome. And I, which is pretty exciting, I actually got MVP, Most Valuable Professional for the Women in Security Awards for doing the mentoring and everything else with the organisation and the industry and the regular column. So it was pretty exciting.
But that's fantastic. And have you seen over the course of your career a little bit more of an increase in women in that space?
It's definitely improving. Yeah. I think the statistics is roughly between 17 and 18% female participation in cyber, which, to be honest, is still too low.
Yeah.
But I think the whole conversation, I've been in cyber and IT for over 20 years now. It makes me feel like the furniture in the room sometimes. I've been there so long. But literally it's the conversations are changing and the audience, the group's changing. And you can see that in it. I think it is definitely getting better. We've still got a lot of work to do. But, yeah, definitely improving.
It's good that you can see that improvement, yeah. You'd mentioned that you have been in the industry for about 20 years. What are some of the other things that you've done previously? Or I know we were talking before that you have a pretty important advisory role that you're attending to down here in Melbourne. Do you want to share a little bit about your work there?
Yeah, so I'm deputy chair for the Australian Information Security Association Board of Directors. So I help run the Members Association, which I think we have around 14,000 members now, all in the cyber sort of security industry. As you said, I'm down here at the moment for the cyber conference, which is pretty exciting for the next few days, which is always about, I think it's about 6,000 people we're roughly expecting this year, which is huge when you're sitting in there and you're going through the convention center and there's 6,000 people. It's a lot of people. But yeah, every year come down and sort of help support that over the year. And obviously a lot of other responsibilities around the member sort of advocacy and things like that as well. But yeah, been in cyber industry for 20 plus years. Anything from what you would call the red team and the blue team and purple team, which is essentially red team is the ethical hacking, breaking into systems side of things. Blue team is the defending side of the organization and purple team is somewhere in the middle. And I kind of one of probably helps the fact of my ability to sort of the communication and the highly technical side. I've never chosen a side. Usually in cyber, you would be either a red team kind of person or a blue team person or a purple team. And I've kind of scattered my whole career across the whole three areas. I've never chosen which side I wanted to sit on, which is kind of makes me a little bit more able to support in that sort of V size or fractional size. It gives me that unique kind of perspective, I guess, which certainly helps.
And I'm sure that there are, you don't want those areas working in a silo anyway, because the blue team could be over here doing one thing and the red team, and if they spoke to each other, then I imagine that they could benefit from what their experience. 100%.
And I kind of find that in the, like in the industry itself, as we kind of need that complete different viewpoint. So we need to bring them all together more and have those open conversations. And even with, you know, expanding the female participation in the industry, I think more diverse thoughts, more different views of how we look things, different cultural backgrounds, everything will help, I think, because it obviously, you know, we've been doing this for quite a long time and I don't think we're getting better at it. I think we're trying, certainly trying hard, but there's, you know, breaches, I think it's roughly one every 8 minutes now, which is a little scary. So, it's, you know, the fact is we kind of need to keep looking at it a little bit differently and trying to do things a bit different.
Yeah. And it seems that that is absolutely the focus for you across everything that you do. It's approaching things a little bit differently, making things more accessible and understandable to a wider audience when it comes to cybersecurity. Whereas I would say that from an outside perspective, a lot of the traditional ways of educating people on cybersecurity is just scaremongering. Do you think that there is a bit too much emphasis on the scaremongering side of things, or do you think it's an appropriate level of fear because the potential consequences are so significant?
I think it's, from my perspective, I feel the scaremongering is probably, a lot of people do it and a lot of people push that agenda, and that's kind of the way most sort of educators or people trying to make that sort of difference in that awareness base kind of go to. I'm more of a education by sort of putting across the knowledge, telling the stories, making that personal connection. I think the personal connection with the individual of why it's important to do things, not just trying to scare them into doing something. So if particularly say if you're educating an organization, if you can sit there and make each of the individuals find the personal reason why it's valuable to them or why they need to engage in that particular topic. And I usually approach education by going, if I can teach you how to be much safer at home in your own personal life and the reasons why, you bring that to the work anyway and you bring that across into the industry and the organizations. And the stories I found seems to really engage a lot better than the scaremongering. The scaremongering, yes, you'll get that initial effect where people go, oh, I really need to do this, I really need to pay attention. But after a little bit, it just goes away and they don't really hold that knowledge. But if you tell the story, I find stories kind of work really well, which kind of works well with me, I suppose, with the writing and everything else. But it kind of, seems to engage and they seem to remember it a little bit better. But, for me, I think personal connection over scaremongering, 100%.
Well, like you said, it's not that initial fear factor that then sort of fades away. It's connecting it to an everyday motivation or area of their life that each time they come across that, it's almost reinforcing the message, which is really important. In terms of, I know you said that you work with parents and kids and business owners, so there's quite a spread there, but they probably, especially those who are potentially a bit older or a little bit less familiar with the risks out there, could be very overwhelmed. what's the best place to start? Do you start with, obviously you start with the story and you find that why that's important to them. What sort of step one where you go, all right, if you take one thing away from this conversation, let it be this?
It's a good question. I like that question. Essentially, I think really that one thing that I try and ensure that everyone in any of the conversations or any of the training that I do is probably the biggest thing is really you don't need to know what all the risks are. You don't need to know all the issues out there. You don't need to know everything about how to keep yourself safe. I think the most important thing is having that kind of healthy level of suspicion.
Yep.
So not overly paranoid. You don't have to be paranoid about everything. But if you sit there and you go, does it look too good to be true? Is this something that do I get it all the time? Is it something that I would normally get? But have that healthy level of going, maybe not sure if this is something I would normally do or normally get or normally have access to. And obviously people aren't going to give you an iPhone for $2 or $5 and things like that. So if it literally is too good to be true, probably is.
Yeah.
Probably the second thing that I always probably reinforce is to kind of just understand once you have that sort of healthy level of suspicion is just trying to understand that very basics around sort of, you know, what you can do as an individual to kind of keep yourself a little bit safer. So sort of, you know, with that healthy level of suspicion, say you could take that over into, say, social media or what you post online by going, is there anything in these images or something that I'm about to post or something I'm about to share that could probably be used against me? And just have that pause moment where you go, should I really do this? Is this something that's going to come back and, you know, cause me an issue later on? So it's just healthy level of suspicion and remember to do a slight pause and go, is there anything in the picture? Is there anything that I'm posting here that could be problematic that long-term sort of space?
Yeah. Do you find that that's a pretty significant knowledge gap, particularly for millennials? We were the original social media people, and so when it first started it all seemed pretty innocuous and it was people would be pretty blasé with what they were putting on social media and online. Are people surprised by what you advise against them putting photos of? I assume you're referencing sort of kids' schools or something like that.
Yes, 100%. Particularly the kids' school. Like, as a parent myself, you know, I'm sure most parents sit there and when the kids go back to school or they're starting, you know, year one, year two, year three, or particularly that young primary school age, the parents are excited. They're starting school. They're going back to school. And, you know, they take the photos, the school uniforms, the background of the school. They got the, for someone with, you know, ethical hacking kind of skill set as myself, the data you can take from those, I could find potentially you're telling me how old your child is. You could be telling me your child's name. You could be telling me the exact location where they are at the particular time. You could be taking it even from your home. If you've got location services on when you're taking photos, you could be giving me your exact GPS location inside the photo itself, or I can find it with open source intelligence, finding where artifacts are behind you. And it's super easy to find things these days. So it's just sitting there going,
is this necessary?
Is it necessary? Yeah, share it with your family, your friends, like that smaller kind of group of friends or your connection or your local family. But is it really necessary as a public kind of post, or is it something you need to spread that kind of wider viewpoint? And particularly if we're talking, you know, when you're going on holidays, if you're posting that in a public forum as someone, malicious hacker for viewpoint, you could be telling me you're not home. I could go to your home when you're not there.
Especially if they know where it is.
Particularly if you've posted before saying you've just bought a house or you've, you know, this is where you're living, start putting all these little pieces together and it forms such an easy sort of puzzle for someone with that kind of mindset together. And, yeah, a lot of the time not one individual post is enough to cause any problems. But if you put four or five different things from birthdays to holidays to taking a photo of a new car you bought and you got a number plate and so many different little pizza pieces to put it together can be quite dangerous and risky.
Yeah, the accumulation of all that information.
Yes, 100%. So it's, and I find that weirdly us millennials, some of us are more surprised about it, some of the others. I think the seniors don't understand, a lot of the seniors, like our parents kind of ages, don't really understand some of the risks. They understand that there is a risk. They just don't understand how to sort of manage some of that. So in that audience, it's more around here's the things here, because they're used to the old-fashioned kind of values and they just trust what people say is real. So we've got to change their mindset. Our sort of age group, I think it's more of the, you know, we're still a little blasé, to be honest, around some of the stuff our sort of age
I know
groups.
I certainly posted on Facebook and Instagram when I bought a house. That was
Everyone
everyone can find my address.
Everyone does. And you're excited about these things. Yeah. And I think if you've got a, say, your social media, if you've got a private account and you don't, you only share it and you've only really got, you know, your personal friends and your family connected, there's less risk.
Does that so, yeah, I was going to ask, does privating your account actually make a difference?
It helps.
Yeah.
It doesn't stop someone like myself or someone that has that real malicious intent from getting some of that content. It certainly slows it down.
Yeah.
Usually the problem is there is if you're connected to friends and sometimes you can find out who your friends' groups are and theirs isn't private and they like your posts or share your posts and things like that, it does break outside of that private group.
Yeah.
So there is ways around it. Mm. We can certainly find some more stuff, and just having a few of those photos from things that they've shared or liked or something like that can still give out similar kind of stuff, but it certainly helps.
Yeah.
Certainly better to have that private group than not have the private group. But yes, I think it's and I think for the younger group, like that sort of, I would say, teens down.
Yep.
A lot of them, they see the privacy as something they've already kind of lost. They don't see the consequence to it as much as probably the older kind of groups do. At least the older groups, we might be a little blasé about it and we might still do it anyway, but at least we kind of see that there is still the consequences and we are giving up something. But the that real younger sort of group, that those next two generations, is not really seeing the same amount of risk. They feel like that's just part of normal life, part of, and it is to them, like they've grown up on that and that's been, you know, they've had them since they were little. I'm a bit more reserved with my kids. I try and control some of that access, but I always find it's a balance.
Yeah.
You've got to find, don't over-restrict, but don't let full access either. Yeah. You've got to find the balance.
Because otherwise they're coming home being like, but everyone else has it.
Yeah. And so you've got to find the balance. And that's one thing I always do to parents when I have the school conversations is going, yes, encourage the open conversations and go, there's rules. We need to follow the rules and we need to do what is appropriate. And if you see things that you think is a bit, you know, concerning or out of the unusual, come to us. But it's with that younger group, it's about encouraging the conversation. So going, you are allowed to come to me, even if I don't like what you're going to tell me or what you've done, have that conversation with me and be that safe place conversation. Yeah. And that'll help prevent that. But I think, we've got a big challenge, I think, with that younger two generations around kind of encouraging them to understand that giving up all their information and being tracked with data for marketing and everything else, you are actually giving up quite a lot when you're doing that. It certainly has some benefits, and you can, it's a bit of a way up of, you know, if it's, is it better or is it worse? But it's their understanding of that. They don't see any risk at all and any concern, and they're just willing to just go, let's give it all up.
It's just part of life. They know all my stuff.
Yep.
Who cares, sort of thing.
Yeah. And it's a bit of a strange way to look at, like, for our generation, it's kind of going, seems a bit strange, you know, like we're still blasé and we still don't care so much about some of the
social
media.
But we remember the switch from, you know, nothing is online to everything is online. Yep. So there is a before and an after, at least.
I tell my kids that I used to have a phone on the wall that I used to spin the dial and I'm like going, Dad, you're old.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny how things have changed, and you're right. Like, we saw it where there was basically very, very minimal, and you know, even computers-wise, it wasn't introduced until I was in high school. There was a few, I think a couple of Macs in primary school, but
you could go on like really KidPix or Tony Hawk Skater Pro or something.
And that was about it, right? Yeah. Like, there was so little of it, and now it is literally everywhere. Yeah. So,
and you can't, I think the main difference is for the younger generation, they can't avoid it. It's integrated into their everyday life.
Yep. And I think that's part of the whole learning the personal connection to it and sort of around that conversation. It is literally what you said, like, there is no avoiding it anymore. It is out there. It is online. And even with the, you know, the breaches, like every 8 minutes, like these are happening all the time. Our data is out there.
Yeah.
It's available and we're all technically at risk. And I could, to be honest, I could probably find my data on the dark web. I could probably find yours on the dark web. It is literally out there. It's just really the main thing for everybody is that healthy level of suspicion and understanding how to reduce your risk.
Yeah.
And that's literally it.
Yeah.
It's because particularly if you look at the non-consumer side, so they're not home everyday kind of people, if you look at businesses wise, is literally a breach is going to happen no matter what the organization does, how well prepared they are. Literally the goal now for any cyber security team in any organization is literally when they break through that first wall, mm-hmm. how do we slow them down and make it so painful
that they give up?
That they give up, or they get very, very little, and it's
yeah.
as little consequence to us as possible. That's literally all we can do now is slow them down. There is no, I think when I first started in cyber, there was that whole castle, moat, and wall kind yeah. of scenario where you would defend all from the outside. There is no wall anymore.
Yeah.
Literally, everyone works from home, everyone works from anywhere they like anymore, and used to have conversations. I'm still a big fan of don't use free public Wi-Fi.
Yeah, we get that. Our yeah. IT team is big on the no yeah. public Wi-Fi. Yeah.
And I think that's still very important, but it's more around people start to do that. They use mm-hmm. the airport Wi-Fi. They use motel Wi-Fi. I always say use your hotspot on your phone. Yeah. We all have good data plans now, so yeah. just use your own. But literally it's kind of got to the point where every device is untrusted.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't matter what you've got, where you are, it's untrusted. You have to authenticate everything, secure everything, and yeah, just reduce the risk, which is easier said than done.
Yes, it definitely is. And I think the other issue that I see from the outside is anything to do with cybersecurity, it changes at a lightning speed. So staying, well, I don't know if you can stay ahead of it, but keeping up with it must be a significant concern.
It's huge. And I think that that's kind of a key point there too, I think, is it does move so fast, particularly if we're talking AI introduction now, so yeah. the artificial intelligence, and then you've got quantum coming on the horizon as well.
What's quantum?
So quantum computing will be essentially pretty much, it'll give the AI and computing power. So essentially any of the encryption that we have now that would probably take, say, our passwords or something it would take us 20 years to break if we have a nice secure password. With yep. quantum computing, which basically will make phenomenal computing power, essentially it will break it in seconds.
Okay.
So pretty much anything with standard encryption that we all think is great and secured and nice and perfect now will be useless by great. The time it turns up. Obviously, people in the industry and, we're working on what they call post-quantum computing and security and everything else to try and help prevent that from becoming such a big issue. But we could be talking another, what was they called? The Y2K moment where everyone thought the whole world yeah. was going to end. It could be a similar scenario to that. You don't know. You don't know yeah. how it's going to pan out. But literally within the next 5 years, 10 years max, quantum will be a complete reality. And mm-hmm. it will make the computing power we have now look like it's nothing.
Okay.
It'll just change everything. And if you couple that with AI, the power and capacity that quantum will give AI will be phenomenal. It'll mm-hmm. literally change the ability of what AI will be able to do, the computing power. It will realistically, I think, put it on that cusp of where it could go. It could become real artificial yeah. intelligence point where it'll have that kind of computing power. So it's
sort of sci-fi come to life.
Yeah, literally the movies will come to life yeah. kind of scenario. So I think as far as AI goes, I think is from a security standpoint at current times, it's already being used by malicious actors and, those bad guys and girls in the hacker space now to try and break organizations. And once upon a time when you saw a scam email come through, we'd say, look for bad grammar, look for, mistakes like that. AI tools now are making it so it looks exactly like yeah. a real one coming from your organization. That's so hard to pick.
Yeah.
So it's changing the game and it's making it easier for the bad guys and girls to do what they do. So yeah. it's in on the other side that is helping us as defenders, because we can yeah. use the same kind of capability to kind of spot those mistakes. And I think the biggest concern for me, and I'm sort of seeing a bit more now, is the what they call the deep fake videos and audio, yeah. which is scary.
Yeah.
Literally, I've scared a few organizations where it's saying, oh, that we're perfect, there's no sort of risk, no one's going to get us. And I've made of their CEO or one of their directors
saying something
that they would never want to yeah. say and never want to tell their organization. I think
unhinged.
something a little unhinged. And they look at it and go, and it, literally you can do that now in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Literally, and make it look realistic. You've got, I think there was in Queensland, because I'm from Queensland up in Brisbane, the mayor of the Sunshine Coast, her face when she was first appointed as mayor for the Sunshine Coast, I think it was about 18 months ago, a little bit longer, her face was being used inside Zoom calls for a scam charity kind of call that they were getting around. They got thousands and thousands of dollars from people using her face saying that we're yeah. raising money for these charities, and that kind of stuff is going to happen so much more.
Mm.
That's the part that's going to be hard for us to, as a society, kind of manage going. Because if you look at just social media, it's hard to trust now what is a real video, what is an AI video. And for someone that looks at that kind of stuff all day, you can see the signs.
Yep.
But as the platforms get better, they will get harder to find and harder to see. Like at the moment, social media is kind of going, you need to put a flag on it saying it's AI made, but they don't all do that.
No. That's so sort of putting the onus and the trust back on the bad guys.
Yep. And it's that kind of stuff, I think. And even with like if you've probably seen like the text messages like going, you know, hey, Mum, I've got, you know, I'm stuck on the side of the road. Can you send me some money? That kind of stuff is now going to voice calls. I do a bit of a talk about in some of my education around, you know, the scenario is where you would, you know, a grandparent is getting a phone call saying, I'm stuck on the side of the road, kids are in the car, I need a tow truck. And the scenario is the credit card won't work and can they provide, and it's his daughter's voice on the phone asking him
to help. Scary,
And for the seniors or in our society, they trust. You can hear the voice. It sounds like his daughter's. Maybe sounds a little off, but if someone's in that situation, you can kind of go, oh, it might sound a bit weird, they're a bit stressed, and you kind of ignore the kind of the little bit of issue.
And presumably they would panic as well and be like, oh, my gosh.
Everyone's freaking out. So in those kind of scenarios, they're happening now. Like those phone calls are happening. And
so what's the mitigation for that, like having a safe word or something?
100%. You've definitely picked up.
I seem to remember that from my early Stranger Danger
Danger. And I do the Stranger Danger with kids. I think it's really effective and for the online world as well. So essentially my advice all the time is with your family and friends, have that, you know, pre kind of canned, what's our safe word? What's our question that I'm going to ask you? What do we, if you don't have a pre canned one or a pre organized one, what is something you know most people wouldn't know about that person that you can ask them and get the right answer, and that can sort of verify. But I always say, if you can't do that, hang up.
Yeah, hang up and call them back on their actual number.
Exactly that, because you sit there and people go, I can't hang up. They're like, they're stuck on the side of the road. What if that is a real
issue? It takes 10 seconds.
Hang up, call them back. Mm. They answer and they go, yes, why'd you hang up on me? You're like,
great.
I just verified that that is real.
Yeah.
So, and if they don't, you're going, what are you talking about? You've also just verified that that is a scam. Mm. And so literally you kind of, sounds a bit scary to hang up, but 100% hang up.
Well, it's worth the 10 seconds of downtime or pause in the conversation for a lot of heartache later. Yep.
And I think it's for some of these scams, like the real ones that are happening, I've seen, you know, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 kind of charges coming off to these poor people.
Yeah.
Never going to get it back, particularly in some of the seniors if they're on pensions and things like that. It's a lot of money for some of them, even if it's just $1,000 for a tow truck.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money.
Especially, like you said, on the pension and living off super, it makes a huge dent.
Yeah. So it's an interesting space, and 100% it's almost impossible to keep up. I think you just sort of keep with the basics, keep you sort of understanding, and for a security professional is just trying to sort of keep a little bit abreast of where some of that stuff is going.
Yeah.
You'll never keep up 100%, but we can try.
We can try.
We can try. But yes. Deepfakes, video cloning, that kind of stuff, and quantum on the horizon is going to be entertaining for sure.
Yeah. Is there anything that excites you about all the possibilities that come with something like quantum, or are you mostly concerned?
I try to be a bit of a positive kind of person. I think there's definitely some big risks and definitely concerns, but I think quantum and AI together literally could probably, if we're talking, say, cancer and things like that, the computing power that these platforms could be given to process so much data and so much evidence and so much mathematical calculations, they could probably cure some of that kind of stuff in probably 1% of the time that a human doing that same kind of work in the background and save us so much time. So I think even with, you know, security and moving forward, they will be just as much of a part of us as the humans doing the work. I think there'll always be a bit of both, particularly in the cyberspace. I think you need the human, more creative kind of way to look at things. But I think it will save us so much time, so much effort. It'll do a lot of the mundane tasks and everything else. Yeah. So I think there's huge potential.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's going to get exciting. And I'm not sure if I'll still be working in security by the time it comes. But if I am, I think it will be, it'll be very interesting.
Well, even just as an onlooker, regardless of if you're still actively in the industry.
I'll be still doing it when I'm 90, probably. It's okay.
Well, is there anything else you would like to be able to – what do you do in your spare time, if you have any?
Mostly write, to be honest. Write or hang out with the kids. I think that's probably the two main things I do. But I think writing is probably my second passion and probably something that I don't actually tell most people, being a multi-award-winning now published author. When I was in early primary school, I could barely read and write.
Oh, okay.
So it kind of...
It's come to you later.
It's come to me sort of later. Like I was, single parent family. My dad was a mechanic and essentially I could probably pull a car apart when I was 7 or 8 and probably help him put it back together. But reading and writing was never something he taught me. It wasn't that I didn't have the ability. It was just
not
something that was of interest to him to teach me before I went to that school kind of space. So considering I could barely read and write in those first few years of primary school, it was, to now be that... multi-published author. Yeah. I think I always sort of tell people, I think, follow kind of the random rabbit holes that you get down.
Yeah.
Like literally my writing journey, if you'd asked me probably 6 years ago or 7 years ago when I first started my writing, I would have literally laughed if you'd asked me if I'd ever be a novelist or a writer book. So you never know where the journey's going to take you. So just follow the rabbit holes, I think.
Well, that's the thing. It's never too late. I feel like people get caught up in, I didn't start it earlier, so I can't start it now. I didn't realize. So you said you've had 7 books published in 7 years. Is that about the timeline?
So I'm writing number 7, so I've got 6 books, and I think the publishing is actually about 5.5-6 years.
Yeah.
So it's roughly almost average more than 1 a year.
That's a huge turnaround.
My last book, this one here particularly, took me about 3 months to write. It took longer to do the editing and the publishing process than the writing process.
A lot of admin.
But I have too many juggling hands doing too many different things at the moment. So my newest one, which is Glimmer, which I'm writing now, is probably, I've been sitting on it for about 8 or 9 months, 12 months. So
it's been brewing in the background.
It's taking a bit longer to get through to write it. But I think, so literally almost 1 a year, which is pretty exciting. And I love doing it. And I think I write for about 6 magazines now as well. So.
That's incredible.
I do too many things, but that's okay.
Well, it obviously, all of it is completely connected to they're connected to each other, and there's obviously a lot of passion in the background there.
100%. I think it's the passion that kind of helps it. I think if there wasn't the passion behind it, I don't think I would do so many. I wouldn't write so many columns. Yeah. I wouldn't write so much stuff. But yeah, literally passion certainly helps. But.
Yeah. And what is one thing that you would hope that listeners of today's episode, what would you like them to walk away paying attention to or actioning in their own lives?
Probably from anyone listening, I think the biggest key, I think, is most people sit there and they say, oh, there's breach happening all the time. It's one after another.
There was one in Qantas yesterday. Yep, I got an email.
Yep. Another one, which is crazy. But anyway, but literally a lot of people sitting there going, why do we bother? Why? Yeah. There's nothing we can do. It's kind of all out there. But I think one thing I'd like everyone to take is just go, you can still do some basic things. You can still minimize your risk, for your data account being stolen, for your money being taken from the bank accounts, by just doing that sort of bare basics, by, setting up your multi-factor authentication, having backups of your own photos in case something happens and things like that. Because I've seen people where they lose years and years and years of family photos and things like that.
That's so devastating.
Pre-preparing, having a backup somewhere, cloud storage, external drive, something, but just doing that nice fundamental stuff. And don't use the same password, please, for all your accounts. Please use a password. But literally the key is you can do some things.
Yeah.
You can reduce your risk. So please try.
Yeah,
it's not worth the effort. It's not going to get anywhere. You can definitely reduce your risk and just be a little suspicious, please.
Yeah. Yeah, like you said, it's something we say a lot here with particularly our accounting clients. If it's too good to be true, it is. I think it rings true in a lot of those sorts of spaces because, like you said, no one's giving you an iPhone for $2. In the same way that we tell clients, if someone's telling you you will pay zero tax, they're wrong. It's just one of those things that a healthy amount of suspicion and the rest of it comes with just education and awareness, which is exactly what you're working on.
Yes, 100%. And I think cybersecurity and cyber education, it is literally all about us humans.
Yeah.
It's not about technology. Yes, from someone that has very, very technical roots, I think it is literally about the people.
Mm.
We need to, as the people, we need to understand and educate each other. And And I think that's one of the things that I always do with the parents and the kids is going, teach each other, sort of bounce backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
We all learn from each other. Doesn't matter how much you know and how much you don't know. I think, yeah, just keep talking about it, keep educating each other. And if you see something, say something to somebody.
Yeah.
Have the conversations. And particularly with teenagers, I think open conversations, open communication, 100% key.
Yeah, because I feel like there would definitely be a tendency with parents and teenagers especially that both parties think that they know more than the other, whereas they could really benefit from sharing in between. And, yeah, being that safe space is important, and sort of for the more old school parent ways of thinking, that was always the case. You know, it used to be the, if you're stuck somewhere and it's 3 a.m., just because I'm going to be cross about it doesn't mean you don't call me. I'll still come and get you. Yep. It's the same with anything to do with a cyber issue. It's absolutely the same principles. It's just the landscape in which the danger is happening is slightly different.
Yes. Love that. That's a good way to put it. And I 100% agree. I think, it's just change of environment. The conversations are the same. The risks are still the same, just slightly different landscape.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much for coming in and chatting to us today, Craig. I know you've come a long way. Like you said, you're from Brisbane, so we appreciate you. I know you didn't come down just for this, but it's nice to have you here to have a proper conversation, and we will definitely include all of the details for Cyber Unicorns and all your books and everything like that in the episode description. But we really appreciate you sharing your insight because it's a really, really important topic. And like you said, it doesn't matter whether you're a business owner, a parent. I don't know why children would be listening to a professional service podcast, but you never know. But everyone can take something from it. And the more that they educate themselves and action things in their personal life, it will then help in their work life as well.
100%. And it's an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much.